You're listening to a Bucks Plus audio production on the Bucks Plus Network.
Your weekly pulse on the Milwaukee Bucks, straight from a Bucks legend. This is Here District with Marcus Johnson, alongside his son and 1995 NCAA champion, Chris. Here's MJ.
All right, welcome to the Fantastic Voyage, the Here District. I'm the captain of this vessel. I'm the captain of, you know what song that is, don't you, Junior? Of this vessel.
I do.
So I got my first mate, Chris Johnson, my son, the only father and son tandem to win a national championship at the same school in college, UCLA. And Junior was a big part of that success story for UCLA. But we're honored and privileged to have just an old friend and just a great teammate, great businessman and all that good stuff. Great, great, great family guy. Junior Brisbane, welcome to Here District, man.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I saw that UCLA on Chris's sweater up there. And,
yeah.
And my shoulder started twitching. But anyway.
Well, you know, and I wanted, let's just start there because I was just curious. So you played at Washington High School, East Chicago, Indiana. You guys were 29-0 or whatever your senior year. You had a teammate, Pete Turgovich, that I played with at UCLA, who used to always talk about you and talk about how good you were. Did UCLA recruit you and Pete together, or was it always going to be Louisville and schools more toward the Midwest? What do you recall about those days, man?
No, what I'll tell you is even from the start of our year, senior year, Pete wanted to go to UCLA. I mean, that was always his dream. Now, no one knew whether he was going to be recruited at all by UCLA, but his dream was always to go to UCLA. And he was the number one player on our high school team. He averaged the most points. A lot of people thought he should have been Mr. Basketball in Indiana at the time. And so, you know, UCLA did recruit him, and Denny came out and recruited him, and he visited, and he signed with UCLA. But in that process, Denny became friends with the freshman coach at my high school, and after he signed Pete Turgovich, freshman coach was like, well, you need to come back and look at this other player on our team, you know. And so Denny, you know, came back, and I remember walking into the locker room, and, you know, Denny was there with the freshman coach, and that was the start of his recruiting. And I visited Louisville, and obviously ended up going there. But, no, at that time, it's kind of funny. I mean, you know, you could visit as many schools as you wanted to. There was no limit. So we were going every weekend just because somebody gave us a free ticket and would feed us and put us up. So that was kind of what happened back then.
Came back with fat pockets, like, yeah, yeah. Let's go. Ball State? Yeah, why not? Yeah, you know, yeah. No. What other schools were you considering at that time besides Louisville?
Well, yeah, visited Indiana State, you know, in the Midwest there, Northwestern, visited Western Kentucky, North Carolina State, Texas at El Paso, all, you know, and well, I'm trying to remember who else we visited. But if I hadn't gone to Louisville, I would have gone to North Carolina State. That they had a real connection at my high school back then.
Tim Stoddard, the baseball pitcher. Yeah, okay. Now, he was teammate in high school also,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, he was one of, you know, we had seven seniors that year, and he went on and signed and went to North Carolina State and, you know, played with David Thompson and the guys, and we won't talk about that game against UCLA, but...
Let's not. Okay. Moving right along. No, that was in semifinals. We actually beat them by 20 in St. Louis the first game of the year after... They were coming off a suspension or something the year before, and then Jamal Wilkes kind of locked down David Thompson. But in the rematch game, David Thompson was every bit of David Thompson, and man, was he one of the most spectacular people? Talk about David Thompson, man. People, when I hear Anthony Edwards, and I'm not knocking the young fella, he is just spoken out of lack of exposure to what was going on back in the era because of, you know, lack of exposure. We didn't have the TV and all that stuff, but. When you talk about there was no athletes, you know, back in that era pre-Michael Jordan, David Thompson, man, what are your memories of David Thompson?
Well, David and I and a bunch of other guys from North Carolina State, when I first really got to see him up close and play with him, I was on the United States team when the Russians came over to play in the United States. And we played six games against the Russians, but I got to practice and play with and against him for 2 weeks.
Okay.
And he was only 6'4", but, I mean, in an instant, the guy was up top of the backboard. And he was quick. I mean, he could just do it all. If anything, I'd say, you know, maybe he couldn't dribble as well with his left hand, but he didn't need to because he's going to jump over you with his right hand. So,
right.
But from an athletic, from a skill standpoint, from an ability, you know, there he ranks up there with the best leapers, best players that ever played in the game and in the NBA. So when you hear things like that from the young guys, you just know that, you know, it's from not really knowing and not really studying what went on before their time.
Well, and he, you know, you talk about Anthony Edwards, he kind of reminds me just in the sense that he had this feathery jump shot. That's the thing about David Thompson. As you know, you don't often see that combination like guys like myself, but guys that can really get up and jump, but can also shoot with that kind of touch that he had. His jumper was so smooth and pretty, man.
Yeah, he was one of the best. And it's amazing that he didn't know much about him because David, when he signed his last contract, was the highest paid player on a team sport in the world.
800,000 with Denver Nuggets. Yeah, Denver Nuggets. I remember that. Yep. We were in the playoffs that year against Denver my rookie year in 1978 when they made that announcement before the game. I remember that. Yeah, they brought him out, Carl Shear, and yeah, that was a big to-do back in those days. Yep.
Yeah, absolutely.
Junior, I had a question for you about Coach Crum in Louisville. I've been always fascinated with the connection between UCLA and Louisville, Coach Crum building the success of that program. How much of Coach Wooden's influence did Coach Crum bring to Louisville in coaching you guys? And what was it like during that time, just playing under Coach Crum and building that program at Louisville?
You know, I didn't know until later on, my senior year when I actually, you know, season was over with and I spent some time with Pete Turkovich. And we were just talking about, you know, how was it at Louisville? How was it at UCLA? And we started talking about the practices. And we did exactly everything that you guys did at UCLA. We practiced the same drills. We started practice the same way. I mean, and Pete said, well, the first week, you know, you would play games and they keep stats and whoever was the top five, that was the starting five, you know, starting the next week. And we did exactly the same thing. And Coach Crum never gave us any, you know, what they call Newt Rockne speeches. It was always, you know, hey, if you guys can't get up to play 30 games of basketball, you know, how are you going to be successful in this life? So it was almost a mirror image of what Pete said went on at UCLA was what went on at Louisville with Coach Crum.
Yeah. Well, did you make $20 an hour operating the snowblower on the football field like I did at UCLA?
No, I had to leave off the basketball court.
but you did. You were telling me a story. You did work where at the Ford plant just when you want to make some extra cash.
Yeah, we weren't that fortunate like the UCLA guys. We had to actually get a job.
But, a job you had to show up at. Yeah,
right. Show up at. Yeah, I worked at the Ford truck plant, and I just prayed that nobody bought a truck that we worked on.
The chassis were a little shaky, and what was going
on? Yeah, our favorite line was, "Don't worry about it; they'll get it down the line."
That's hilarious, man. But look, talking about Pete Turkovich. And again, Pete was a great player. You know, I love playing with Pete. Just great. He turned into a great defensive player. 6'6". He came into UCLA kind of this Pete Maravich type. You know how, you know, you like to clone guys after certain superstars. So it was kind of, he was Pistol Pete. You know, he was 6'6", could handle, could shoot, floppy hair. I think he even had a little bit of the floppy sock thing going on. Well, when you see the trajectory of guys like you and like Pete, and Pete we thought was a can't miss as a freshman. He was averaging 25, 30 points a game as a freshman. What do you think is the difference, was the difference between where your career kind of took off and his kind of plateaued out? I mean, if you can comment on that. I don't know if you know anything about – I'm not even talking about his work ethic or nothing like that. I know you had a tremendous work ethic, but – Just for young people, when you're younger and you're seeing players that are better than you in high school and all that, I think you're a great example of just, you know, you keep working, you keep going at it, you know, and keep having faith in your abilities and faith in everything else. Good things can happen for you. But what do you think was the difference in the two of you in terms of your career trajectory?
Well, I think you hit it on the head. Pete came in with all the accolades. He came in. And everyone had told him how good he was, how great he was. You know, he was the next Pete Maravich. You didn't mention the wristbands. He had wristbands all the way up to his elbows, and Pistol Pete did. And I came in where nobody told me that hey, you're the best since, you know, pick a name. So, you know, and I got down to Louisville, and man, first practice, I said, man, these brothers are jumping all over the rim. They don't even go to school here. You know, that was just guys coming in off the street playing. So I knew that I had to work hard if I was going to get a chance to even play. And that was the mode all the way through. You know, you just had to keep working. Nobody told you you were the best and at anything. So, work.
Yeah, and it paid off for you. You're All-American, two-time Missouri Valley Conference Player of the Year. That's when the Valley was really, really, really tough back in those days. But then you were drafted. You were a Laker, eighth pick of the draft. I think you were a Laker for all of, what, about 10 minutes or so?
2 weeks. I had two solid weeks.
But did you – but also, you were with the Lakers for 2 weeks before the trade was consummated. So what was that like? Did you feel like you were going to Los Angeles, that you were going to be Hollywood, you're just going to take all my parts in movie roles and all that kind of good stuff? I mean, no. But what was that like? I mean, just that little – that period of time before the trade went down.
Well, I was on the airplane with an agent attorney, and we were flying to L.A. And we flew out of Chicago, and there was a little article in the back of the Chicago Sun-Times. I mean, it couldn't have been more than a one-inch article, and it said Jabbar to Lakers. And it said it's rumored that Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is going to be traded to the Lakers. So when the plane stopped in Denver, attorney got off the plane and made phone calls. And he said, yeah, I think there's something to this. So we landed in L.A. and got picked up in this big limousine at the airport. And they took us to the forum. And Jack Ken Cook was the owner at that time. And when we sat down in front of him to start negotiations, first question was, well, for my attorney was, you know, we're hearing these rumors that Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is going to be traded to the Lakers. What do you think about that? Oh, he said, oh, no. You know, that's not going to happen. When we draft somebody, we want them to be a Laker for life. You know, we drafted you. We want you to be a Laker. So we kept pushing him on that little small article. And he finally he said, well, if it happens, it'll be a 1 in 4 chance. And that's exactly what it was, three for four players.
It was you, Dave Myers.
Elmore Smith.
Yeah, Big E.
And Brian Winters.
Brian Winters, okay, yeah. Former teammate. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Now, was it a major disappointment? What was your perception at that time when it went down?
No, I mean, at that time, all you wanted to do was have a chance to play. I mean, I told people, I don't care if they had a team in Anchorage, Alaska, and I got a chance to play in the NBA, you know, I'm going to live up there. So it didn't matter to me. I never played for the Lakers. You know, obviously there's a lot of history, all that, but you just wanted a chance to play. And Milwaukee, you know, I said, okay, that's as good as anybody, you know. So it you figured with a young team, you'd have a chance to play. So in some ways, it kind of felt a little bit better than going to the Lakers.
Yeah, and your role models in Milwaukee, I mean, you played for Larry Costello, just a legendary Hall of Fame coach, won the Bucks' first championship. But you guys, as I recall, struggled a bit. I mean, the first couple of years, your rookie year, what was that like in Milwaukee?
No, we didn't just struggle. We were terrible.
Okay.
I was being kind.
I know
you're being kind. And even our second year, I mean, we were just young. We were young. Everybody was trying to figure out how they were going to fit in. The older guys on the team didn't want to go through that. Bobby Dandridge, the all-star, you know, he didn't want to go through that. Some of the other guys said, look, you know, I've been centrist. I'd rather be on a team that has a chance to win. So it was a back and forth first year, second year. And then they let Larry go and they brought in Don Nelson 18 games into the second year. And everything changed.
What was it about Nelly that you could see that, you know, he was going to be okay in that position as a head coach?
Well, he had just stopped being a player. So he understood what all we were going through and as a young team. And even we were young together. I mean, Nelly was not a seasoned coach. He was learning. So it was in some ways everybody was learning. We were learning how to play. He was learning how to coach in the NBA. So for a couple years, it gave us a chance to, I think, really grow. And, you know, they made, you know, some good selections as far as in the draft. You know, they picked up, obviously, you know, you and Kent Benson and Sidney Moncrief guys came. So they built the team. And at that time, we were able to all grow and get better together individually and collectively.
Junior, you just mentioned the Bucks drafted my dad. Third pick, 1977. I was curious, what were your impressions of him that first training camp or the first time you guys kind of got matched up on the floor? What were your impressions of MJ?
Well, I had watched him play in college. And the thing, they were, you know, West Coast Pac-10, I think, at that time. And I think you were playing, I'm guessing on the team, but I was just amazed how he'd get an offensive rebound and just go right back up and dunk it. And I mean, it was so fast, and I was sitting there, I was like, you got to be kidding me. You know, nobody, who does that? You know, like that. So we were real interested to see, is this for real or is this just, you know, college hype? And he obviously was, you know, college player of the year. So we knew he could play when he got there. But nobody knew that he was that good when he got to Milwaukee. I mean, we were playing at youth school and pickup games, and he was doing the same thing, getting offensive rebounds, going up and dunking it. And I remember Quinn Buckner coming over to the sideline and say, can you believe that? And we all, you know, we had to look tough, like, oh, we're all tough players. And we go, oh, man, that ain't nothing. Everybody's like, can you believe that? You
know, so. Well, he can't shoot. Yeah.
Well, he didn't have to shoot. But the other thing, you know, I remember is, so we play pickup games, and they were intense. And then, you know, you get to whoever won, got to 12 first, whatever it was. And so we'd take a break and get ready for the next game, and I looked over there. He's over there doing sit-ups and stuff, you know, sideline.
Sit-ups and push-ups, like, baby.
You know, everybody was like, can you believe, is he just doing this, you know, to try and impress us or what? But his work ethic, even from then on, was something that I think really amazed a lot of guys that had been in the league a long time. So it was fun and a great time to see him come into the league.
Well, and Junior, I got into this with Gilbert Arenas on my son Josiah's show that he co-hosts, No Chill with Gil, or Gil's Arena, whatever it is. But he talked about how all the tales of how hard we worked back in those days during the off season were just that, just tales, just baloney. You guys didn't put in that kind of work back. You guys were just drinking and drugging and that and that. But please set the record straight, man. You worked out with me at UCLA, man. You know what we were doing.
Yeah, and that's the unfortunate part about a lot of the young kids. You know, they think the world just started 30 minutes ago. So, you know, they don't realize how much effort, how much time, how you had to be in shape to go to training camp to get in shape. And if you showed up out of condition, as some guys did, I mean, they were throwing up all over the place. And I tell guys today, I said, well, you know, okay, training camp, they practice one time a day. And most of the time, that first hour or so, they're working with their individual coaches or whatever. But we practice twice a day, 2 hours from 10 to 12 and back at 6 to 8. And that first hour, we didn't even touch a basketball. It was all defensive drills and things. Then you had a five-minute break. Then you scrimmage for an hour. And by the third day, you could barely get out of bed. You know, everything hurt. But that was what we did. And the thought process was they had to tear your body down to build it back up, to get ready to get through a season. And then when I see a lot of these guys getting hurt into the season, I just wonder if that's because physically they aren't prepared to make it through 82 games.
Yeah, and the thing, June, that people don't realize, too, is that nowadays training camp may be a week, 2 weeks, or 2 days, or maybe a week or two. We went like my rookie year, I know for sure, we went like a whole month. I mean, 28 straight days in between exhibition games, whatever. Dang. But, Chris, we went 2 a days for like that whole month before the regular season started, man. It was tough.
That's crazy.
And then we pressed. We pressed everybody that started the season full court, you know. So if it hadn't been for Nelly, I probably could have played 4 more years.
You're listening to a Bucks Plus audio production.
Oh, yeah, and you were an Iron Man. You had a great streak. But that Milwaukee team, 1977, the thing that a lot of things stand out to me in terms of just our chemistry, how well we got along. But I want to go to the owner, Jim Fitzgerald, and what a class act he was at the time, Junior. And look, man, I didn't appreciate him until he actually signed me when I was with Golden State. I'd been out of the league a couple of years. But he tried to get me and the rest of us, but you guys took advantage of it, involved in a cable TV deal. He and a guy named Daniels out of Denver, I believe was his name. They were just starting this cable TV thing going on. And it was the early years of it, Chris, and he wanted to get us all in on the ground floor. But I had gone through, I think, one of my holdouts or something. And you know, my mother was in that don't trust the white man mode. And he just trying to get that money back they gave you. And so I didn't participate in the investment, but you, Nelly, Quinn, a few other guys. What was the investment? What was the return? If you remember, I know you do.
I remember because you know, that was really the only money I saved. But to answer your question, you had to put up. Well, let me go back. They were installing cable systems in various cities. And so they were putting the cable system into Green Bay, Appleton, and De Pere, Wisconsin. And so when they did that, then people were then willing to pay was $9 a month to get all these other channels that they couldn't get. And so he came to us and said, hey, guys, I think this is going to work. If you put up $150,000 and you could, I think, could pay it over 2 or 3 years, and, you know, then we'll see what the return is going to be. So there were no guarantees like every investment is. And so everybody that put up $150,000, I think when they sold the system in the next 3 or 4 years, he gave them a check for $900,000.
Wow. That's
so, and that was obviously the most money any of us had ever seen before. And really, the biggest amount of money that I was able to save during all of my playing days.
Yeah, and so that whole situation in Milwaukee was, you know, some of my best memories in basketball in terms of our chemistry and how well we got along. I remember my first week there, you took me to Terrans to get some fried chicken, get a chicken wing dinner, and Terrans was this little tavern, Chris, you know, little tavern in the hood, but they made the best fried chicken, man. But the thing about the Bucks also, Junior, is that I remember you used to put in so much time and energy on your shooting, and you became one of the deadliest shooters in the league. But you and Dick Shuloff, I mean, remember Dick Shuloff at U School, you had the key, but people don't understand the kind of work that you put into. You didn't come into the game as a great shooter. You tell me just that evolution of how that happened for you.
I was working at a camp, basketball camp in the summertime with Dick Motta. And Dick was on first talking to the kids, and I was just sitting there listening, and he was telling the kids, how many of you want to be a great shooter? And obviously everybody raises their hand. And he said, well, how many of you guys shoot, 100 times a day? And, maybe two or three kids raise their hand. And he said, if you want to be a great shooter, you got to shoot this ball 50,000 times in the summer. Mm. And I'm sitting there and I'm going, I need to do that. So I got Dick Shuloff, who's a great friend. And we had 7 spots on the floor going around in a semicircle around the basket. And we would shoot 10 shots at each spot and just keep moving back and forth. And we keep track of how many shots. And over that summer, I made it to 50,000 shots. And that was how I became a much better or outside shooter. And you think about it, if you do something, Malcolm Gladwell in his book, 10,000 hours put in, yes, be good at anything. And it was no different. I mean, that took all summer, being in the gym every day, shooting, 500 to 1,000 times every day. So.
Now, did you continue that or did you just get to that level where now you could kind of scale it back a little bit or a lot or whatever? Or did you try and stay with that for a while?
No, we stayed with that. I did that. I know I made the 50,000 3 years in a row.
Wow. Okay.
And then we kind of cut back and didn't shoot 50,000 every summer after that, for various reasons. That was the difference. That was the difference right there.
Well, I see why your feet were bad, man. Okay, yeah. 50,000 3 years. God dang! And plus, you were like, what did your Ironman streak get up to? 400 or 300? What was it?
I think it was like 300. And the only reason they just mentioned it, I didn't. I think it was 370 something games, like that. Yeah. Which I would say, looking back on it, I had to be absolutely crazy to do that.
Well, Ed, you were the one. And I was telling Chris this story. I averaged like 10 rebounds a game my rookie year. And you came to me after the season, man, you go kill yourself, man. If you average like between 7 and 8 rebounds a game for a small forward, you're doing just fine. And I actually took your advice, on that and scaled it back a bit.
Yeah, because, Marcus was going in there, Chris, and you were jumping over centers and everybody getting rebounds, Yeah. We would sit on the bench and say, man, that can't last that long, because there's too many games, there's too much wear and tear on your body, and he cut it down, and you still became an all-star, kind of stuff. So, because you have very few small forwards, we even averaging 7-8 point rebounds a game.
Yeah, no. So now those teams – looking back, and this is why I was so happy for the Bucks when they won it in 2021, first one in whatever, 40, 50 years, whatever that is, 50 years, I think. Yeah, wow. Second championship in 50 years. But we came close. Man, we came so close. 7th game against Denver, 7th game against – I thought that Seattle series, Chris, was our best chance. Seattle had Gus Williams and Dennis Johnson in the backcourt, Johnny Johnson from Mesmer High School in Milwaukee as a small forward. My matchup, me and him almost got into a fight around game 5 or 6 in Milwaukee, and Bob Lanier go, yeah, that's right, man, that's right, him. Jack Sikma in the middle, Freddie Brown, downtown Freddie Brown. I mean, they had won the championship the year before. They were defending champions, and we had them down 3-2. But I'm telling you, Chris, the reason we did not win this series, as sure as I'm sitting here, and we talked about Junior and some of the injuries, but that was that the beginning of the plantar fasciitis? Was that the beginning of the foot
no, issues? No, actually, I drove in, and I don't believe they call it offensive foul, but Sikma threw his hip over, and I ended up coming down on my back.
Okay.
And, so then they took me out of the game, and the doctor said, well, you got swelling in your back. And this was after the 5th game or what. And so we were going back to Milwaukee. So, I mean, that morning when they came and examined me, they said, can you bend over and touch the floor? And I could do that. So I told them I wanted to play, and they wouldn't let me play.
Yeah. Wow.
They wouldn't let me play. So, I came there.
Who's that, Haskell and Heinzelman?
Yeah, well, I won't mention any names, but
Jesus.
From there. But the team doctors, put it that way, he would not clear me to play that night.
Wow. And then so we wind up losing, Chris. We're up 3-2.
know.
And the Sonics beat us in Milwaukee in the series clinching game for us. And yeah. And that's when Johnny Johnson got in my face and started, you know, and got kind of took me out. And I give him credit. Go ahead.
Was Johnny Johnson the original point forward? Is that who they
He played point forward. I won't say original, but okay. Some guys, Robert Reed played the position, but Johnny Johnson, because they had Gus and DJ, Dennis Johnson, Johnny would handle the ball at the top of the key, and they would cut off us down screens, Lonnie Shelton and Jack Sickman, curl and cut, and just wreak havoc offensively. But, I mean, with Junior not available, and I didn't realize that you felt like you could have played, but they held you out of that game and held you out of game seven also, right?
Or did you?
He
gave you a bunch of reasons, you know, lower back, you know, spinal cord, all those kind of things like that. But, yeah, that was – I agree with you. That was our best chance. I mean, we had hype. You know, that was – Dave Myers was there. You know, we had Bob Lanier. You know, and then Dave retired after that year, which I think they never really replaced him. But and the reason why I thought we never could beat Boston and Philly, we were always that one person, I thought, too small.
Yeah. We were trying to match up against whoever, Caldwell Jones at 7 feet with myself or Junior, and we'd play small. And plus, I mean, the year they picked up Moses Malone in 83, I believe it was, we had swept the Celtics. They had picked up Moses.
That's tough.
And that was unfair. That was almost unfair back in those days, man.
Yeah, but if you remember, we won the first game. We were the only team that beat them.
Yep.
And we would have won the second game. Brian took that last second shot that hit inside the rim and rattled and then came out. If that goes down, you know, we're up 2-0 on Philadelphia. And knowing that team, you know, well, they would have never given up. They had too many great players. But it becomes a whole different series. Coming back to Milwaukee up 2-0, you know, it's a whole different thing.
Was that the Moses Malone 4-4-4 year?
It was 4-5-4,
but you know, some kind of way the five turns into four. So
Okay,
4-5-4. But I'd be remiss not talking about that Sixers team. Dr. J, man, did you grow up idolizing Doc the way I did in L.A.? Just what place did he hold in the pantheon of greatness when you were coming up?
Well, you know, being in Louisville where they had an ABA team, you know, we saw him play all the time.
Wow.
And he still has one of the most memorable dunks I've ever seen. And
describe it.
Yeah. So he was with the New Jersey Nets, and they came down and shot, and Artis got the rebound, threw it out, and the Colonels were on a fast break down to the other end of the basket. And everybody's running down except for Artis. Artis kind of stayed there at the free throw line. And Dr. J steals the ball on the right side of the floor. And he starts going down. And everybody in the stands, including myself, stands up because he's going in on Artis. And so you're saying, what's going to happen? And he goes in from the right side, jumps up in the air, turns his back to Artis as Artis jumps up, glides by him, then reaches back and dunks the ball. And that's what the whole place went crazy.
See, Anthony Edwards, I hope you're listening to this.
And he said there was no talent. But the funniest part, so we had Dr. J and Artis come in and talk to the eighth graders in Louisville. So before they got to speak, we had them in a little room. And one of the guys that didn't know any better asked Dr. J, what's your most memorable dunk? And he holds his hand up and points to Artis.
Oh, man. That is hilarious, man. People don't understand just how spectacular. It's just that's the only word I can say that really does it justice, how spectacular Doc was. But so speaking of those days, man, and I need some closure on this. So I want you to help me out, buddy. So I was known back in those days, Chris, I would hold out a couple of times. Not a whole lot, but, you know, I was making like $110,000, $125,000 a year and all these other, you know, James Edwards, because of Ted Stepien, I think, in Cleveland. He was paying Scott Whitman $500,000, and it just got crazy. And so I'm like, I'm not playing for this. And if I ain't getting paid, I'm not going to show up. So I would hold out, and it's 1 year I held out. I was telling Sydney I held out until mid-December. And I was hoping the Bucks would be about 6-12 around that time, but they were 12-6. And I was like, well, it's time to get back. And that's when Sidney Myers, my third year.
Sidney's third year.
Yeah, I think it's the year that he emerged as a real star player in the league. But Junior, what were y'all saying behind my back? I mean, what were y'all saying? You know, was it like, man, this selfish LA hot wannabe Hollywood? What was the perception?
No.
Tell the truth, man. I need closure, man.
No, it really truly wasn't any of that. I mean, everybody kept waiting on you to come back. And because we felt everybody wanted to win. And you were a big part of that team, and everybody knew that you were underpaid. So there was no animosity. No, it was just, we understand the Bucks need to just pony up and pay the money. So it was just like, we were just waiting on you to come back. That was all it was. Yeah.
Well, and so now in true transparency, Chris, so Brian Winters had retired. Brian and Quinn were our captains. And so now we've got a captain spot open. And so we're going to have a vote in a week, see who's going to be the next captain, Chris. So, you know, I'm all-star, lead the team in scoring. I'm buying Gatorade and Kool-Aid and everything and juice for the guys after practice and training camp. You know, I'm doing what I'm politicking. You know, I want to be captain. So we take the vote for captain, and I don't get named captain, Chris. Guess who beats me out for captain? Chris. Junior Bridgman.
Captain of the ball.
We had a vote. You were named captain. You and Quinn, I believe, when after Brian retired, we had a vote. I'm telling you, I know it as sure as I'm.
Is that how you remember it, Junior?
The disappointment was palpable. You don't remember what you wanted. You were voted captain. Check with Harvey, check with Sidney, check with anybody. We had a team vote, bro. And they named you captain, and you were such a great guy. We were good friends. I didn't hold it against you. I was just disappointed because I thought I had a pretty good shot at it. But you were named captain of that team. But I was just coming off of a holdout, and so I always thought it was because, you know, the guys looked at me like, oh, we don't know if we're gonna be here or not. So we go, we better vote for somebody that we know is gonna show up.
I need to go back because I don't remember it. And if I would have gladly given you the.
It
didn't mean it really. I mean, I don't, that's probably correct. I mean, I think I remember Quinn, but it would only matter if you were on the starting group, which you were. So
exactly.
Yeah.
Well, again, I thought it spoke to just your leadership qualities. Absolutely. Your reliability. And, you know, we were a tight knit group. Everybody got along. We loved each other. We still communicate today, Chris. We've got a group text and we're always in contact. Sidney Jr., myself, Paul Pressey, constant contact with each other. So no, but I think the main point, and that's from my perspective, but it just showed the, and that's why, like I said, I couldn't be mad. It's like, I mean, well, I voted for him too, so hey, it's all good, you know. So now, playoff disappointments, we get traded to the Clippers, and we're not gonna spend a whole lot of time on this because it's not worth it. But man, was it as much of a of a shell shock in terms of just the whole organizational quality. I remember Nelly telling me, Junior, all right, Em, I'm going to send you home, send you to the Clippers. Now, it's not the Lakers. They do things a lot differently than the Lakers do out there. So, you know, just letting you know. But what was your first impressions that first couple of weeks, month or whatever as a Los Angeles Clipper?
Well, I was older and obviously getting near the end of my career. And so I thought being in the warm weather would help you physically. You know, and help you. So that's how I looked at it. I didn't even think about that much different or what the differences were going to be in organizations or how they approach things or how they coach the team and all of that. But after getting there, I tell you, the biggest disappointment to me was how the guys on the team couldn't understand and couldn't really figure out how to get along as a team. I mean, you had some guys that would try to hurt their own guys in practice. You had guys that wanted to be the star because we're in LA and they wanted to be the star again and all those kind of things. So that part was, especially at the end of my career, was really disappointing to have to kind of go through all of that when it should just, for me, been about, okay, guys, what do we have to do to win? And win in LA, and then everybody will enjoy the success of being on a winning team. But that was disappointing, along with I'll put it this way. I was going to say not a good organization, but I'd say I think one of the magazines rated the Clippers the worst organization in all professional sports, and they lived up to that heading. So that was disappointing.
Well, and then you contrast that with the Lakers, what Dr. Buss was doing with that team, with Magic and Kareem, and training camps in Santa Barbara and private plane, MGM private jets and all that. And we're having training camps in Pomona, at Cal Poly Pomona, staying at the Econo Lodge or whatever little, you know, people, when I tell them we stayed at like a, whatever it was, like a Motel 86 or whatever, Econo Lodge type of a place. The Clippers did not spare every expense in making us comfortable back in those days. But the Wine Garden, remember that? The Wine Garden, YMCA down on Vermont and Century in the heart of South Central.
And, what?
And I remember Jay Murphy, Chris, from Boston College, white guy, said, "Is it safe for me to drive down here?" I was like, "Yeah, but keep your eyes peeled, young fella. stay alert, man." But
Yep.
But it's, and the chemistry, like you say, was totally different. The chemistry in Milwaukee was great. We were all movie buffs, Chris. I'm a test Junior's memory with a couple of movie lines, and I want to see if you can name the movie that these movie lines came from. The first one, just two of them. Delmer can't play with pain. Delmer can't play with pain.
North Dallas 40.
So, Chris, that was a running back, Delmer, who refused to get an injection.
I know.
Refused to get an injection.
You made me watch the movie. You've made me watch that movie.
Two sack, the other lineman, they would come in and tease him. He played and tore that hamstring up, and his career was over. Okay.
Yep.
And then the second line is, "You're asking an awful lot for $2.
Richard Pryor.
Come back Tuesday night for my regular healing service. Take this $2 yeah. with you. I want to dance. I want to run. I want to jump.
Which way is up?
That was the healing service. My name is Harold with $2. Harold Washington, $2.
Reverend Harold Washington, my feet.
Yep. Harold, my feet. What can I do for you and your feet, Harold? I want to run. I want to dance. I want to jump. Yeah, you asking an awful lot for $2.
$2. Yeah.
That was kind of our recurring lines when we teased each other. Yeah, you're asking an awful lot for $2, man. Come on, man. But we had a great time, man. And I thought that one of the things that really coalesced that chemistry was the addition of Lorenzo Romar. And I ain't gonna spend a lot of time on Robert, but with the LA guy, Chris, you know, straight out of Compton, I'm thinking, yeah, I got a drinking buddy, I got a hangout buddy and all that. He came in with the Bible studies and all that, but with this terrific sense of humor and great ability to impersonate people and all that, man. But I thought he was just a tremendous addition, just as a person, man, to that basketball team.
Oh, he was, and he loved to play one on one after every practice.
Yeah.
Man, come on, let's play one on one. Say, bro, man, I want to go home and lay down. Let's play one on one. But great, great person, great individual. Yeah. I thought what the team really needed at that time, and put a lot of guys on a different path.
Yeah,
the funny thing I remember is you'd be on an airplane and he'd be sitting next to you and he'd go, "Hey, tell me something." And you go, "What's that, bro?" He'd say, "Are you a Christian?" And he'd catch guys off guard. And it was so funny. Guys were like, "Well, no, man, I like my life the way it is, you know."
Yeah.
But he challenged a lot of people and changed a lot of lives on that team.
Hey, Coach, at UCLA, yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that Romar was charging my recruitment at UCLA. It was like a big reason why I was so comfortable at UCLA, and I love that man. I just saw him recently, and, you know, the effect he has on your life as a man is just immeasurable.
Yeah, and I tease him, and Marcus will remember this, so he couldn't remember the play. So I said, "You a coach, you couldn't remember the plays back then." because we'd be in the huddle. Nelly would put him in, and we're walking out, and he'd say, June, what do I do? And I said, just run down the baseline and go to the right and get out of the way.
Our famous story between me and Lorenzo, because he came out one time and ran the wrong play, and then Nelly yelled at him, and then I was like, yeah, I was wondering what you was doing. He's like, hey, man, next time tell me if I'm running the wrong play. I was like, well, I thought you was doing your own
thing. You're the point guard.
Yeah, you're the point guard. I thought you were trying to, like, you'd improvise or something, man. No, I ain't improvising, man. I didn't know what the play was, man. So, and then he had a spot-on impersonation of Bob Lanier. Bob Lanier, smoking a cigarette at halftime. So tell me, anyway, if my man cuts through, am I supposed to switch or do you want me to get out there and hedge? What am I supposed to be doing? but those are different times. We had guys smoking in the locker room, and Nelly in the team prayer with a cigarette dangling out of his mouth and hand in the prayer huddle and all that.
Wow, that's great.
But man, some great, great days.
You're listening to a Bucks Plus audio production.
But just during that time, let's segue into the Bridgman business empire. It was during that time that you talked about your meetings with Jim Fitzgerald. I talked about him as an owner and kind of him laying the groundwork for you for future endeavors and philosophies and all that. But the whole Wendy's thing, and I always self-deprecating talk about how I said, ain't nobody go buy no square hamburgers. But people assume that it was just this cash cow right off the bat, but it wasn't. And I tell Chris Jr. that if I would have given you $200,000 or $300,000 and we lost that money, that first Wendy's, we had never spoke again. I'd have been, later for Jr. But just talk about that process, what it took for you to get successful in that aspect of your career.
Well, and you weren't the only one. John McLaughlin, had turned down the Wendy's opportunity even before I did. And everybody.
Larry Fleischer, who brought that to you? Was it Larry Fleischer? I'm trying to remember.
It was actually Paul Silas, and he knew Larry, and so, but it was Paul and I that went to Wendy's together. And we opened up the first store in Brooklyn, Bedford-Stuyvesant, tough area. And we didn't know what we were doing. And we lost all the money that we put into it. And I won't say the best thing, but someone broke into the restaurant appropriately on April Fool's Day and couldn't get in the safe. So they decided to take the safe with them. And near as we could tell, it fell on one of the guys at the front door because there was blood on around the front door. And they got mad and went in and set the restaurant on fire. So, but what it did was it stopped us losing money every week. And when we finally got it rebuilt, Paul didn't want anything else to do with it. He went back to the NBA. I ended up selling it to some guys there, that were operating in New York. And Wendy said, well, you spent all that time in Milwaukee. Why don't you get involved in Milwaukee? We'll sell you five stores. And yeah, they sold me five stores in the inner city, Capitol Drive, North Avenue, and one over on the south side that weren't very good stores. And just like, people don't say, well, how did you get them turned around? I said it was just like becoming a better basketball player. I mean, we ran those stores 12 to 18 hours or 14 hours, whatever it was. Every day, we turned one crew over three times till you found the right people. But it wasn't until the people really believed that we cared about them that things started to change. And once, we did that by doing a lot of things for people from, somebody's house caught on fire or people were in jail for, moving violations, we were bailing them out and all.
These are your employees. These are your employees, and just showing them just how much you cared about them as people, and they reciprocated by putting in that much extra effort to make the business successful. Yeah,
correct.
That's a great business model. Yep.
Yep. That's what happened, and eventually, stores started to turn around, and Wendy's was happy to give us the rest of the market because Milwaukee wasn't doing that well, and we eventually, turned it around, and then it was just a matter of adding stores. And people said, well, you added stores because you wanted to make more money. And I said, no, because it really wasn't making a lot of money because you had to keep adding debt. And so they kept adding debt. We would we promote somebody. So it was really about promoting people and giving them a chance to make more money, improve their lives. And that's really the main reason why we grew. And then you turn around, you know, 15 years or so, and you've got all these restaurants and you paid the debt down. So now you start to really make money. So we'd have given you your money back. It would have just taken a long time.
No, but it's a great success story. And there's a story about the woman you heard on a radio show or something. Share that with us.
True story. I was working at the restaurant over in Oklahoma, and this lady came in. And at that time, Wendy's had one register up front where you'd order, and then you'd move down the line. And I was in what they call the coordinator position. All that meant was I would make sure you had everything on your order on a tray and then kind of slide it forward to you. So I'm doing that, and this lady, and so she looks down, she looks up, and she looks down again, she looks up again, and she doesn't say anything. And then she just grabs her tray and sits down, and I'm driving in the next morning, and I don't remember the program in Milwaukee, but kind of like, you know, Toot Bob, like Ted or whatever it is. And lady calls in and she goes, you know, I think it's a shame. And they said, well, ma'am, what are you talking about? She said, I just think it's a real, real shame. And they said, what are you talking about? I think it's a shame that these basketball players, these NBA ball players make all this money. And when they get out of basketball, the only job they can get is working at Wendy's. I saw Jay Bridges working at Wendy's, you know.
Oh,
that's funny. That's funny. Junior, what went into the move into the relationship with Coca-Cola? Like your thought process, how did that work? The timing of everything as far as the Wendy's franchise and all of that.
You know, and so much of everything is timing and being in the kind of right place and being able to take advantage of it. And it was no different with becoming a Coca-Cola bottler. You know, we were a big client, so to speak. You know, we served Coca-Cola in all our restaurants. And so through their interaction and our grapevine, we heard that they were looking for new bottlers. And so I remember back to when we had the free basketball camp in Milwaukee, Coca-Cola was a sponsor of it. But then when I looked around at, okay, if you're talking about legacy and passing something down, I could find people that maybe were in second generation in the restaurant business, but not really a lot more than that. When I looked at the Coca-Cola business, there were people that were fourth and fifth, and in some cases, sixth generation. You know, some guys had been in the Coca-Cola business family-wise since 1890. And so I was like, you know, there's got to be a reason why. So I said, you know, when you're talking about a legacy or passing it down to your kids, this probably is what is going to last longer than the restaurant business. So we applied to become a bottler and went through the whole process and took a year and a half. And finally they agreed, you know, awarded the bottler franchise or area, and we became the third new bottler that they've added in the last 40 years.
Wow. Yeah. Wow, that's incredible. Okay, so now NBA ownership. When did that first come on your radar? Any flirtations? Anything you want to share on that, we'd appreciate.
Yeah, it first, maybe when Herb Cole was the owner way back when, there were rumors that he wanted to sell. And so I won't mention his name, but there's another gentleman from family from Racine, Wisconsin, very well off. And so he called and said, hey, you know, I'm thinking about going after the Bucks. You have any interest in getting involved? And, you know, I said, well, yeah, you know, I'd like to, and talk to the league. And they thought the Bucks were worth, you know, a couple hundred million dollars at the most at that time. And so he went through the whole process, and then Herb decided he wasn't going to sell. And the team kept going, and then I heard that they were going, Herb was going to sell it again. And that time I said, you know, they called and asked, were you interested? The newspapers did. And I said, well, yeah, you know, I'd be interested in being a part, but, you know, not the majority or the main guy or anything like that. And so he sold it then to Mark Lazary and Wes Edens, and met with them, and then it just didn't feel like the timing was right, or it just didn't feel right, so I didn't do it. And then I met you know, year and a half ago, Jimmy Haslam, you know, one of the owners, and we just kind of hit it off, you know, kind of same thoughts about things and about life and about what's really important in life. And so he's really the reason that he talked me into getting involved and saying, you know, we'll make it make sense. And if you get involved, you know, you can be involved. You can have, you know, some say or being involved in all our meetings and talk about what's going on and all those kind of things. So I said, well, if that's the case, then I'll seriously look at it. And it became a reality. So.
And what responsibility does an owner, I mean, how much time does that take? I know you still got to run your businesses and be actively involved in that. And what's the time kind of requirements of ownership like in the NBA?
Your main owner or the what they call the governor, the one that is on the board of governors that represents the team, his requirements on time and all are going to be a lot more. You know, he's actually involved in a lot more things and decisions. But that was one of the things that I kind of talked to them about, saying, you know, I just don't want to be someone that you call and say, we decided to do A, B, and C and D. They said, no, we want you involved in those decisions with us also. So, you know, once it gets going, you know, we'll have calls every week, and then they'll have a call, you know, I think probably every other week or so with the, you know, with the team, with Doc and those guys to find out, you know, talk about what's going on. And then you'll have your business call where, you know, you'll discuss what's going on, you know, how much money they're making. Yeah, right. So, but, and so it will be more phone calls, and then, you know, you'll come to the games just to kind of see what's going on or go on the road, things like that. So, the interesting, you can be as involved as you want to be, or they're allowing me to be as involved as I want to be, and be there as much as you as I can or want to be also.
We're talking about money. I mean, the players of today owe a debt of gratitude to yourself and guys like Oscar Robertson. But in the, it's funny, I was telling Chris how people would always ask me why I wasn't a player rep. I said, we got the president and Bob Lanier. We got the vice president and Junior Brady. We got Quinn Buckner. We got Steve Mix. I mean, we had all the officers of the players union playing for the Milwaukee Bucks. But talk about just the challenge, the struggle dealing with the owners back in those days to get the 52% of the growth, whatever it was that you guys, the basketball related income, all the stuff that was going on. I mean, you were right in the thick of that fight. What was that like?
Yeah, it was. Players don't realize how close we came to being on strike twice back then. That you know, we left the last meeting with no agreement. And we had scheduled a strike, you know, the next day at noon. And and it's just that, I mean, the owners group, there were normally four or five of the owners representing their group. And they had, you know, the high powered law firms in New York sitting on the other side of the table. And these guys were tough. I mean, and they were just tough business people. And the thing that I realized was basketball, which was everything to us. I mean, that was our whole life. To them, it was just one of many businesses that they had. So, and in a lot of cases, it wasn't even, it was the minor business that they had, you know, because we looked at basketball as, you know, these guys are making a lot of money. And then when you really got into it, no, I mean, you know, if they had revenue of $50 million, that was a small business for a lot of these people. So, you know, they had no problem being tough about something that was minor in their whole makeup of companies. So, but David Stern, I'll give it to him. Both times he stayed up all night talking to owners and finally getting the vote from the owners group that avoided the strike the next morning. I mean, because we left the meetings just prepared to call everybody and say, hey, we're going on strike. You know, we don't have a collective bargaining agreement.
Mm. Junior, I guess I had one more question for you just on how you view success and as an owner of the Milwaukee Bucks, aside from the wins and losses, how do you measure success for the Bucks?
You know, I think that if you can help someone improve their life and improve where they're going in life, then I think you can really say that you've been successful. Wins and losses, yeah, all of that's important because you're playing a sport where wins and losses determine whether, you know, you're successful from that standpoint. But when I look at our team and the teams that we played on the Bucks, I mean, the guys that we played with and against ended up becoming great human beings and great people and made a difference in society and made a difference in a lot of different ways and were examples. And it isn't about, well, they went on and made this amount of money or did these things. It's about, did they contribute to society? Were they an example for people to want to be like them? And did they live good lives? And I would say that, you know, that's where we had tremendous success, that as teams that, you know, can't be measured in wins and losses and going forward.
And to that end, I mean, Lloyd Walton, teammate of ours, Dr. Lloyd Walton, Lloyd's got a PhD or a doctor of education or whatever it is he's got. But he it just kind of shocked me that he was like the first guy off of our team. When you think about all the intellectual minds we had between yourself and Quinn and Brian Winters and Bob Lanier. But Lloyd, you were instrumental in coming in and talking to the rookies through his position in the Players Association. And those are the kinds of messages that you're going to help pass on to this current iteration of the Milwaukee Bucks.
Yeah, that and, you know, how you can be taken advantage of in the business world and how people will be looking to take advantage of them and how the more money you have, the easier it may be because you're saying, well, you know, if I lose X number of dollars, it's not that big a deal kind of going forward. And just getting the guys to realize that they don't have to be involved in everything. But when I look at the guys today, you know, you see their example would be like LeBron James or that's involved in this and that, and, you know, on TV or promoting this or that, or they look at a Kevin Durant that's, you know, buying a part of a soccer team and all that. And they say, man, you know, I should be doing all these things. Yes and no. You know, if you're making a lot of money, you know, under the right circumstances, maybe. But unless you really know what you're doing and what the business is, what I tell guys is why get involved in things that you're relying upon somebody else when you don't have to? You'll be plenty of time when you stop playing and hopefully you've amassed enough money where you can do those things and you can now be involved in overseeing them. Don't think that you just have to jump out there and own all these or be invested in all these things because you see somebody else doing it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and one of the other just iconic ventures that you're involved with, the purchasing of Ebony and Jet. And those were our staples, Chris. You know,
My mom was the Jet Beauty centerfold of the Jet week. My mom was Jet Beauty of the week.
I remember we were dating around that time too. I wasn't too happy about that. Looking at my girlfriend in a bathing suit in the middle of Jet magazine, but that's a whole other story. That photographer dude, I'm still looking for him. But anyway, I digress. But man, what went into that? I got to mention that because that's been such a staple in the African American community for ever since I can remember.
You know, there were two main thoughts that we had. One, I mean, I remember I grew up right outside of Chicago, Illinois, and we would ride into Chicago, Michigan Avenue, and you would see the Ebony sign, big Ebony sign on the side of the building or in front of the building, and that just made you feel good, you know, that somebody, you know, had a business that was, boom, doing like that. And we all grew up reading Ebony. And you see the centerfolds in the barbershop, Marcus. Everybody had them all up around the windows. But we just thought that it was too iconic of a brand to go by the wayside. And so that was the first reason why we got involved. And the second reason was there are, at that time, 75 years of stories about not just Black culture, but about life in America. And some of those stories need to be told. And so the daughter's doing it, and they just signed a deal with Lionsgate. And so they're going to be producing some of those stories that, you know, were written about in Ebony, or stories that people need to remember or need to become familiar with. And the best example I will give you is Hidden Figures, about the lady that, that was first written about in Ebony magazine a number of years ago. And that's where they got the idea, I think, just lost her name, that came up with the idea of making that into a movie. But there's 75 years of stories like that that need to be told in ways like that. I mean, if not movies, and the miniseries or documentaries or whatever it is like that.
Well, you know, and I know your daughter Edie's running it, and we're working together a little bit. I've got a screenplay on integrating the fire department in Los Angeles. That's just it's iconic, and I'm telling her I'm almost done with the rewrite. I'll be getting it to her real soon. But the thing about Ebony and Jet, I remember at UCLA Junior, I'm on the bus on a road trip reading Ebony or Jet, I forget which one, and my teammate Brett Vroman from Utah, grew up in a Mormon environment in Utah, and he's kind of noticing me the past few weeks, and he's like, what is this thing of having a magazine for Black people? I mean, what if they had a magazine just for white people? So I also had a copy of Newsweek in my bag. And I said, hey, look through this Newsweek, and if you can find me a story on an American Black person in this magazine, let me know. He looked through the Newsweek. There were a couple of stories on some African dictators, but nothing on anybody from America. I see. So that's why we've got to have that alternative in our community, because we don't get that same type of exposure in just mainstream Newsweek or Time or whatever it is. So, yeah.
You know, and with somebody that we both know, I remember before I even got into the league, they did an article about Wayne Embry, and Wayne Embry being the first Black general manager. And, you know, I never knew that. You didn't think about that. But, you know, there's another story. You know, how did Wayne get to that point? You know, it probably would help Mr. Edwards out to just, you know, hear something about people and what they did and just to kind of read. But that's what I'm saying. Those are all stories that need to be told, need to be documented, and need to be put on a screen where people can see what really went on, not just in the Black community, but in America in some significant way.
They are American stories, and you are the epitome of the American success story, doing janitorial work with your dad at what, 5 o'clock in the morning in high school. I mean, man, to go from there to your career as a professional athlete, to segue that into what you've done in the business world, man, it's just been nothing short of remarkable. Tell Eden she needs to do a story on you, man. That's where the story needs to come from, man. But just as we end, so I was on the Bridgman Estate. How many acres you got down in Louisville? What's that about? About 30 or 48, 50, 60? What is that?
Yeah, well, we'll just say it's pretty good size.
It's big. Way. It's big. Yeah. But and your wife Doris, lovely wife Doris, told me this story. But just tell us this as we get out of here. But you got a couple of street signs on the property, and what does that mean to you guys?
You know, it was something that we wanted to do, and for the kids, to show them that when they come out, this just didn't happen. And so I grew up on Grace Street in East Chicago, and I went back there and looked at it, and, you know, it's all duplexes and, you know, 1,400, 1,500 square foot houses. And she grew up on 32nd Street in Louisville down in the West End in the projects. And so we took two streets, and we had a street sign put up in front of one of the buildings, and it's 32nd Street interacting with Gray Street. And so when the kids look at it, they say, well, what's that mean? Then we can kind of tell them, you know, this is where we came from. This is how it all began. It just didn't start here at this property. And for the grandkids also, that no, this was not the beginning, you know, that was the beginning, and give them how it began, where it began, and let them know that, you know, we're we're still fortunate and blessed to be in this situation.
Well, look, man, may God's grace continue to shine on you and your family, doing some great things. So proud of you. Love you, man. You've been a terrific support to me all since 1977 when I first met you, and I just really cherish that friendship. But thanks for joining us here on the Here District, the Fantastic Voyage, Junior Bridger, man. Thank you.
No, thank you, guys. And, Marks, I obviously love you. You've been great. And, Chris, one of my favorite memories is you at coming to Marcus' house during Christmas. You were a little kid, and he had, I don't remember what the toys were, out in the middle of the floor. That was just great to kind of see that excitement way back when. So just love you guys, both of you, and wish you nothing but success with the program going forward. No, it will be successful. So thanks a lot.
All right. Junior Bridgman, the newest owner of the Milwaukee Bucks here on the Here District, the Fantastic Voyage. Thank you.
This has been a Bucks Plus audio production.